This is CliffCentral.com.
All right. Plenty of messages coming in about all kinds of things, including horrible names, but we've been down that road before. By the way, it is the middle of November. You have half a month of November left where you can do as little or as much productive stuff as you'd like. A lot of people are already shutting down and becoming very slow. Oh. It's driving me crazy. But I went to a meeting yesterday, and the people at this meeting, they're going into some big strategy thing in December. So they are using up December, which I think is heroic.
I met someone who is taking off a full month.
Yeah.
Coming up.
Well, schools are, I think, over a month this year, their holiday.
Outrageous. Whatever happened to the good old Victorian workhouse where people were just put into, I mean, 14-year-olds can work. Why not?
No,
but parents are seriously like panicking because the holiday school syndrome is horrible for them.
Yeah, I think schools.
That's what I'm saying. The parents shouldn't have to be subjected to their children hanging around.
Oh, so a seen and not heard thing?
No. Kids must go to work. I don't understand. 9-year-olds are perfectly capable. You saw that one kid in Belgium. There's a child in Belgium in the news this morning. He's 9. He's just got a bachelor's degree in electric engineering.
He's a real house like Doogie Howser.
Good for him. Now, that kid, you should put him in charge of the other kids. You should say, all right, all you other kids, you're going to work for him. And if you haven't built something by Friday, you're all getting no more gruel and porridge.
Child labor is not a thing then, hey?
Not to me.
It's an unpopular opinion, but I don't think the kid will be normal.
Remember that. Don't you dare say that.
No, I don't think he will.
How do you? Like, you're so normal.
Do you remember we went...
I'm Deputy Dr. Phil. I know these things. But if you are... No, he's so ahead of his years at 9 years old.
Yeah.
He is going to... He's now accustomed to being in university, even if it's like he's around adults all the time, and then he'll still go through puberty, and then he'll still have to learn some social cues and etiquette. No, he'll be screwed up.
I've seen these little Japanese girls who can play like Mozart and Rachmaninoff on the piano at age 7.
Yeah, but they don't know how to flirt properly.
Who cares? They can play Rachmaninoff on the piano.
It matters.
Put them on the stage, let them play that on the piano, and let's not worry about them flirting, Sia. Not everyone needs to be a slut like you.
You take that back while I cross my legs.
Some people are learning how to play beautiful classical music at age 7. Look, their parents may occasionally hit them with a bamboo stick, but they can play.
They are not going to be normal.
And no great things have ever come from a complete lack of pain and suffering, right?
Do you reckon he's going to come into his own properly? Like he'll be...
What do you mean? He's going to be developing... something that will make everyone's life better. Watch this kid.
I'm not saying he will achieve greatness.
He won't be normal.
Yes.
He won't be normal.
But that's fine.
He may even burn out under the pressure.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
But you take your chances. What, like giving the child a perfectly normal existence when its brain is so advanced.
Hmm.
What do you want him to do? Be playing with cars in the mud?
Do you know who else isn't normal? A puppy named Narwhal.
What's wrong with... It's called Narwhal?
No, man. N-A-R-W-H-A-L.
Oh,
Am I saying it wrong?
Like Narwhal? Narwhal, yeah.
Narwhal.
It's a narwhal's a...
Narwhal.
It's where a lot of the legends from the ancient seafarers came from mermaids and unicorns and that kind of thing. It's a little... Almost like a small whale with a... It's got a big tusk on the front.
Well, this is an appropriate name then because he has been born with an extra tail on his head.
Wow, were his parents related puppies?
They may have been, but he is really cute, and you actually don't mind the tail. His mom wanted it, it comes out directly like a unicorn from the middle of his forehead.
Yeah, but it's a tail. It's kind of a little freaky.
Do you think so?
Well, it looks like a worm.
Does it wag?
No, so the mom wanted to name him Wipers if it did wag.
The dog mom?
No, the human mom.
All right.
But it didn't wag.
I'm talking about advanced kids. They could be advanced dogs. Shame,
he's cute. I think.
Well, I'm glad they didn't put him down because, you know, these days they a lot of abnormal and, again, not usual creatures, they don't let them live. So I think this is quite interesting.
No, it's very cool. And he's a rescue pup, which is really nice.
Okay.
I mean, I would have gone for him if I went into a rescue place.
He's and he was very there. Different. And you know, if your friends come around for a cup of tea, Leanne, you'd always say to them, look at my dog, Norwal. Look at his tail on his forehead.
How did it come to be that he got this tail on his forehead?
It's called
something like
genetic problems.
Yeah, it's the same as conjoined twins, or maybe he had another bit of a twin in there or something.
While we're on that, I always find it very unhappy that they try to separate the twins. We've got enough people who
Do
are separate from
the
their twins.
Do you think the twins are unhappy about that?
It's quite nice to have one or two who are not separated so we can visit them in the circus or whatever it is they do.
There's a one. You know, I love 60 Minutes, Australia's 60 Minutes. There's a story that I yet have to watch, but it's of three kids that were born together and stuck together.
Three
of them. Yes. Please tell me they were joined at the head. That's the best.
There was one perfectly formed child in the middle.
Oh.
And then two on either side.
Who were like parasitic.
So
twins.
The one in the middle has two legs, and the ones on either side have one leg.
Oh,
each.
He has to carry the other two around?
Well, they've been separated.
And you worried about the 9-year-old's burden?
They're now like 10 or something years old.
That's a burden.
Sorry, I'm just trying to get the picture together. So four legs, four arms.
So don't
three
keep,
heads.
Don't count it like that. But
okay,
yes,
show us how to count. Okay, go on. Let's get a model. Gugu, bring me some plasticine and show me how to count. How do we count?
A fully formed human in the middle.
So put me in the middle, and then we. How do we attach
and
the
And then
other
you've
two?
Got someone on your, under your right arm and someone under your left arm. Two heads.
Under your arm. How do you...
Their heads are under my arm.
Yes.
That's unfortunate.
I thought maybe they were jutting out of the sides.
Especially if you're a sweaty Betty.
So I'm not being crass, but I'm trying to figure this out. Where do you rest your arms? Do you rest them on top of their heads? Or
I never saw them when they were conjoined. I only saw them afterwards.
Oh, so they separated them, but yes. That means that the two...
Two on the sides have one leg each.
Oh.
And then the one has...
Yeah.
Two legs. What's the word? Term?
Everyone's so scared to say normal these days.
And commonly average person.
Wow. You've called him common and average. That's really bad.
Wow.
So, yeah, I want to watch that. Apparently, their mother neglected them in their younger years
you
as
don't
well.
Don't say. She probably drank the whole way through pregnancy as well.
She was scoffing shrooms, man.
Jeez.
You say, Gareth, it's not fair. But think about being stuck to your sibling.
Yeah,
and I would not. I would want that separated and cut within 2 seconds of my life.
Yeah, look, I'm glad it's not a problem I have to deal with. I feel sorry for people who do.
Well, I just really remember watching an Oprah episode around this, and these two girls were now going through puberty, and they were also, you know, as you grow up, you're coming into your own, and you have such distinct personalities, and the two would constantly fight. It's oh man, I hate. I
right,
don't want
to. Let's turn our attention to other things because you know this is kind of disturbing.
It is.
Here's something much less disturbing. There's a woman in Los Angeles. You know they've got a massive homelessness problem in LA and in San Francisco.
The story.
I don't. I
a mean, woman.
What happened?
A woman has been.
No, it's so bad.
Okay.
A woman has been left with PTSD after a man...
Oh, yes, the story!
...threw a bucket of hot diarrhea over her head. Hot diarrhea. Okay, let me play the clip and you get an idea of what's going on.
Hensel was walking to her car near Hollywood's Walk of Fame when, according to police and court records, a transient with schizophrenia and psychotic disorders dumped feces all over her.
A bucket of his diarrhea. It was liquid, hot liquid. I was soaked. And I couldn't see. It was coming off of my eyelashes into my eyes.
Paramedics rushed her to the hospital, and she now needs to be tested for infectious diseases every 3 months.
Oh, my God. That's a real story. That comes out of the Mirror. And she says, this is Heidi von Tassel. She said her homeless attack threw...
But this is the conversation that went on our morning team group on WhatsApp. Gareth sends the story. Gord says, oh my fuck, and repeats in capitals, oh my fuck. Gareth says, hot diarrhea. Gord Lord says, a large, full bucket. He'd been saving it. And she tested positive for several diseases, multiple infections. Gareth, revolting. Gord, from a bucket containing an entire innings of run bum. Think about your last serious run bum. This oak kept it all and poured it over a chick's head.
But he didn't. That's where he's wrong. Because it was hot.
And Gareth says, but it was hot. Gord says, fuck me, hot diarrhea.
Oh.
No.
This is in the running to be the worst story.
No, apparently this happens quite a lot.
Leanne,
similar
please,
things.
With respect, just hold on 1 second. This is the worst story of 2019. The worst.
Yeah.
I've heard lots of disgusting things in my life, but this one has got to be the worst. I mean, that poor woman, you heard her in that clip. She's traumatized.
Well, she's traumatized. She's ill.
She had it in
she's got PTSD.
She had it in her eyelashes. For heaven's sake.
Do you understand how disgusted you are when you just step in dog doo-doo? That's just on your shoe.
Yeah.
And you feel like you can't get rid of just that tiny stench. It's like, it's it's following me.
Hot.
Now imagine it's poured.
And it's hot.
But these things are happening in the area. These homeless, deranged people
are
launching attacks.
No one likes to talk about this, but the fact is that a lot of people are homeless, not because they don't have a home, but because they're mentally ill.
Yes.
And they have serious psychological problems, and they live on the street because they've just been unable to live with other people or in any kind of they will ruin a place that they live in, and ultimately they end up there because there's just nowhere else for them to go.
Even this woman said that she felt some empathy towards this guy because of mental illness.
She stands by that.
She really did?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, eventually.
She's a better man than me.
She says that the moment changed her life, but she still has empathy for her attacker.
I think that is the worst thing that could ever happen to a person. Having a bucket of hot
diarrhea. But if you had to poop in a bucket every day and you saw these wealthier people walking around,
you might get
pissed off.
Yes, but I would never throw... Listen, you have to be a little bit deranged to get to that point, and I'm horrified. I don't know what else to say.
And there's also just the attack itself, because this man pulled her out of the car, dragged her onto the road, into the middle of the road, and then dumped this bucket on her.
Yes, yeah, so
it was very vicious.
It was malice aforethought.
Mm.
It wasn't as if like he was standing on a rooftop and waiting for someone. Yeah, but he has been charged with battery and he's been jailed as well.
Yeah.
And then his records, since he has been jailed, show that he deals with schizophrenia and psychotic disorders.
Yeah. No, it's a serious thing, and you know, when people look at homeless people, they think often we can solve that problem just by putting them in accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't solve the problem. A lot of these people have very serious conditions. Anyway, Natasha sent me this message. She said, my husband and I have decided we don't want to have children.
Mm.
She says, we're telling them tonight.
Oh, yes.
You know, parents, I saw a tweet the other day, and it's from a South African woman. This woman says, I'm teaching my children how to deal with the real world. I'm paying them 30 rands to wash the dishes. And then I also mug them in the corridor afterwards to teach them how the world works.
That's great. That's good parenting right there.
Oh, word. Jeez. Speaking of LA, there was another school shooting.
Yeah.
4 kids injured, 2 dead. I don't know.
What happened? The guy just...
A 16-year-old opened fire.
Okay.
And was his birthday or something?
I used to bring cakes to school on my birthday.
Yeah, I didn't generally...
Sounds a bit extreme.
Fatally wound people on my birthday.
Wow. That's a horrible story. I hate hearing these.
He himself, the shooter, survived a self-inflicted gunshot. Or gunshot
wound.
Right,
he killed himself, right.
He tried to, but he survived it. He's in a grave condition in hospital.
There's just nothing to say about these things.
No, there isn't. It's just, I thought I'd put it out there that another...
Thanks for ruining everyone's morning. It's nice of you.
that it's still happening.
We're having
he had a semi-automatic handgun.
All right, can you just, have you not heard that we've, like, you're ruining everybody's mood? I mean, we were talking about hot diarrhea just a few minutes ago. Now you've made it worse. I didn't think it was possible.
I might have changed the story on purpose. Sure. Okay, here's the thing. You know, in airports and these shared office spaces, you can, there are USB ports that you can directly charge your phone into that.
Sure.
So you don't have to have the little adapter.
Right.
Apparently, people are being warned against using these.
Oh, no.
Because they carry malware.
Oh, no. But it's just a charging port, surely.
No.
You mean it's connected to some, there's some pervert sitting in the room next door busy downloading all your stuff?
Oh, come on.
Or putting a virus on your phone when you're busy just charging it in the airport?
It's actually called juice jacking.
Oh, my. Oh.
Yeah.
So how did we get to this point?
I don't know.
You know how paranoid this makes me?
But again, Gareth, what are they going to do with what's on your computer?
You're not going to find it. I know people who probably have interesting things, and you're not going to find anything on mine. You'll be bored to death. Except for that diarrhea story that was on there.
And
that
a lot of rude pictures from people on WhatsApp groups.
Yeah, probably. I might get arrested for some of the stuff that I've shared with my friends on WhatsApp, but that's about all. Oh. That's the worst that could happen to me.
So now they're actually developing a number of wall chargers or USB wall chargers that stop this happening from happening. It's iPhone jacking or juice jacking, it's called.
All right.
Nothing to look out for.
Thanks. Leanne wants to say he's clearly not in a grave condition. I think I must refer to the shooter.
Yes.
Some other messages. This is from Carl. Says, better to be pissed off than to be pissed on, I always say. Yes, that's a good point. Don't forget, Dion Mayer is joining us in just a few minutes. That's going to be very exciting.
Very cool.
And Gugu says he's been watching Trackers as well.
Yes, I have too.
Very good. good point being made here by somebody. You do banking on your phone. This is from David.
Oh, this is very true. Yeah. How silly of me.
If you do your banking there.
Oh, but hang on. There's no money in my account, so it doesn't matter.
Oh, okay. Well, that solves the Sure. Maybe a kindly passerby would actually put money into your account after they've juice-jacked
for the distress of it all.
Can you imagine? A hacker saying, I saw your bank account and I feel so bad
for you.
You're such a pathetic human being and you've got so little going for you. I've decided to put in 100 bucks.
I've cleared your 300,000 rand debt.
I was feeling generous.
I am a little, like, maybe still stuck in 2008. But, yeah, I don't like having a lot of apps on my phone that are connected to, like, my bank accounts or need some sort of a subscription because of that. I just have this fear of if someone were to get into my phone, they have access to everything. You know, that's a little freaky to me. Mm. My banking app is it. And
surely you have to use your fingerprint for your banking app.
Mm.
And facial recognition sometimes.
Mm.
But rather that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, talking about people being scared of things, the rise of the anti-natalists is on the app.
Oh, I know these people. There's a brilliant guy called David Benatar. He's a professor at, I think, UCT. And he's one of the world's foremost anti-natalists. In fact, I think we spoke to him somewhere in the last year or two about his theories and his philosophy that it would be better to not have been created at all.
Yeah.
It's a very strange way of thinking, and for many of us it's beyond the realm of what we consider philosophy and possibility. What they're saying is that human existence is suffering, and Professor David Benatar says it's the cruelest thing of all is for you to come into existence. He says it would be better if you were never conscious, which I can't. I really, honestly, have tried to wrap my head around.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a very strange outlook. I'm hesitant to say the word negative because he's not inferring that there's a positive or a negative experience to a lack of consciousness. You wouldn't even know you existed. But he said the fact that human existence is such a big bundle of suffering, and I kind of see what he's coming at for the last maybe million years of human evolution and human existence. But currently, I don't think it's so bad. And I think there's a very good argument for life, on the whole, becoming better and better for people, not getting worse and worse. These anti-natalists have missed their calling. They should have been around back in the days when we were fighting saber-toothed tigers and running around in, you know, old bits of leather and eating hooves from, you know, then I would have said, sure, anti-natalists might have had a good argument, but I struggle to understand it. Now, perhaps we should get him on at some point.
That would be fascinating. I would love that.
So tell us about the rest of them. There's a whole...
There are two sort of things that come out of this. The first is that the person themselves, the antinatalist themselves, believes, they have thoughts like, I wish I'd never been born.
Well, that can be remedied. I hate to be obvious about it.
There is a solution. and then the other spin-off is that they don't have children. And you were just reading that tweet a little bit earlier.
From Natasha. Yeah.
Yeah. But yes, that seems to be on the rise. People are definitely seeing their existence as not a gift or a miracle, but rather a harm and an imposition.
Well,
and then adding to that the logic of the questioning of whether I should have a child or not.
With no judgment in the world, you can always opt out.
This is what I'm struggling to understand. What's their feeling then towards being alive? Do they hate being alive? Are they grumpy? Are they just dealing with it but going,
They call it suffering. That life is inevitably all about suffering.
And there's just no goodness in living.
Yeah, it's a very dismal outlook. It's not something I'm comfortable with, I have to be honest.
I wake up
in the morning, I'm very happy to be alive.
The same could be said for agnostic atheists, where you've got people who, in a time of crisis, don't have the ability to phone, to pray to God.
No, I don't think the two are related at all.
You don't?
No, I know plenty of atheists and agnostics who are very emotional, thoughtful people who believe in the transcendent. They believe, you know, they feel something in music and in art and in storytelling, and it moves them tremendously, and they enjoy being human. They like the experience of being alive and being human. I don't know that not having a belief system necessarily detracts from that. But in this case, these antinatalists, they actually think that from the very moment of conception, you're just being born into the cycle of doom. And it's, you know, it's ultimately because it leads to death and we all die, that's not a good reason to come into existence in the first place. Yeah. So they say that the game is not worth the risk.
I think a lot of people who don't necessarily feel this way all the time have at one point in their lives gone, geez, I wish I'd never been born. Especially when you're going through a string of horrible things happening to you in your life.
But that's circumstantial.
Yes, that's true.
And I think that happens to a lot of people.
By the way, David Benatar's book was called Better Never to Have Been, The Harm of Coming into Existence.
Yeah, you see, what a philosophy to be a part of. Well, here he is, one of the greatest authors in South Africa, I dare say the world. A man who's now had one of his books turned into a TV series to great acclaim. He is much celebrated for his writing across the country and the world in any case. And he's here with us this morning. I'm so pleased you managed to take some time to be with us. Thank you so much. Dion Meyer, how nice to see you, sir.
Thank you very much, Gareth. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Wow, look, you've had some career.
Yeah, it's been a wild ride, you know. We were talking last night, we had a book launch at Hyde Park, and we were talking about my first book coming out 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And my mother was surprised, I was surprised, and I never expected this to happen. It sort of all happened by chance. It happened, it started off as a hobby. I never had any inkling that I could write full-time one day.
You mentioned your mother now. She has been able to see the success.
Yeah, she has. She's almost 90 now. She's got Alzheimer's. So she lives very much in the moment.
Right.
And the beautiful thing about that is that every time she sees a book of mine, it's a new surprise to her. But, you know, But yeah, it was wonderful for her.
And she got to understand before she the Alzheimer's became bad, I'm sure, that you were this celebrated author.
Yeah, and she was extremely proud. And I think for her, the coolest thing was that through me, she met all her idols. I remember her meeting Tien Jordan and almost, you know, passing out from pure pleasure. Yeah. So I think, you know, I was very happy that she found that pleasure in the whole thing.
And first of all, congratulations on the TV series, which seems to be acclaimed by everybody. Leanne says she was watching it, and she's been through the first two episodes.
Yeah, I was hooked immediately.
Oh, fantastic! Thank you.
Because it's hard
it's amazing. I think the book was written years ago. Actually.
Yeah, about 10 years ago. Yeah.
So what was the delay, or did someone just approach you?
No, books are constantly being optioned by producers all over the world.
Yeah.
And by the time that we started our own little movie company, film company, a couple of years ago, and at that time, Trackers was my only book that wasn't optioned by someone. And we decided to take that to market. And we went to LA and London. We found some partners. And Mnet came in, ZDF from Germany, HBO, Cinemax from America came in. And it happened fairly quickly, putting the deal together. So it was pure coincidence that Trackers was available. I think Trackers was probably going to be the most difficult book to adapt for a TV series.
Really?
Because
you've written screenplays for movies.
Yes,
you've
I have.
Done two TV series. So
right.
You're not new to this.
No, but Trackers was probably my most complicated book. It's got three strong story strands that sort of weave together in the end. And we had to make some tough creative decisions on what goes in and what do we leave out.
Yeah, it must feel horrible to leave parts out.
It's actually not, because, you know, the novel is the novel. It's always going to be there, and people who want to read it can go read it. The challenge, I think, was always going to be how to make a really good TV series. That was our aim and our hope and our vision. And when we as the writing team, once you share that vision and say nothing is holy, let's use the book as a touchstone, as a foundation, but let's take from that what makes a really good TV series.
But Dion, even in your books, when you write your books, you sometimes have to have that approach because,
again,
your editor or someone you trust will say to you, you know what, this is a great story, but it almost complicates the whole, direction that the book is taking. Yeah. And sometimes you've had to leave things on the cutting room floor, and maybe you pick those up for another book later on.
That often happens. You know, just in the research for every book, only about 10% of the research that you do, really interesting stuff, can go into the book because that's just too much and you don't want to bore the reader. You want to keep the story moving forward. So a lot of it keeps left behind, but you dip into that maybe for a next book or for a new story idea. So nothing goes to waste.
When you started writing and you wrote your first book and it was so successful, the publishing world was very different.
It was, but let me just say my first book was not successful at all.
Not?
No.
And even now, in retrospect, people haven't gone back and read it?
It sold 10, 15 years later, it sold very well. But
there we are.
I was the first Afrikaans author after the end of apartheid who started writing thrillers. And the publishing industry didn't know, my publisher didn't know what to do with this. This was the first manuscript of its kind that they got. So the first thing they told me, my working title was Icarus, because I was a huge Ed McBain fan, the great American crime author, and all his novels had one-word titles. So I thought, that's very cool, I'm going to have the same thing. And they said, no, it doesn't work in Afrikaans. So they turned Icarus into Wie met Vierspiel. And they gave it because, you must remember, under apartheid, the government told us what was good to read and what was bad to read, and what intelligent people and very cultured people, like all Afrikaners, should be, should read, and crime fiction was not amongst that. So they published the book with a very gaudy common cover of a semi-naked woman, you know, really lowbrow stuff, to tell people that if you're intelligent, you shouldn't read this.
It was like they were trying to make it fit.
Well, they were trying to, I think, show that, you know, we will publish this, but we're not proud of it. So it sold about 800 copies. They sent me a letter saying I can buy as many of the other 200 that was left at R1 each because they're going to pulp it. And I did. I bought 20 because I thought it was going to be the last book that I ever get published.
Did you almost give up?
Well, it took so long to have that book published. So by the time it came out, I had already finished a new one, Phoenix in Afrikaans, that became Dead Before Dying in English. And another publisher, a very small publishing house, picked that up. And that was the book that opened doors for me. That was the book that was first published internationally. And it did have a one-word title in Afrikaans, and it did fairly well.
Yeah, I mean, The Last Hunt, Woman in the Blue Cloak, Cobra, 7 Days. We've got some real success stories here when it comes to your bibliography. But the difference between making a TV show and writing a book, it's enormous.
Yeah.
And as I was saying just now, the publishing world has changed so much.
Yeah.
Even though there are probably more people who can read now than there were 20 years ago, the money's gone down. And books are not selling like we'd like them to because there are many other options now. People listen to podcasts, they listen to audiobooks, which I'm sure you're into as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And they binge watch TV series. Right. Well, I think that's cool because it's all storytelling. And, you know, I regard myself as a storyteller, and that gives me the opportunity to use those other media to tell stories too. I'm not always that worried about what is happening to the book world. Books are still doing fine.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at the e-books grew tremendously, and now they've sort of stabilized, and the traditional book has made a comeback. The book industry has changed where every town and every suburb had its own little independent bookstore.
Yeah.
That has changed, but independent bookstores are coming back again. I think you'll always have these phases in the industry, but people are still reading, and I'm always delighted to see how many young people there are at my book launches. There are young people still read, but they do consume entertainment in many other ways as well.
So you mentioned just now that you research a lot for these books because your characters are very fulsome. You've got stories where you need a lot of detail. Things are, you almost want the reader to feel like they're in the position of trying to figure out what's going on with a crime or some sort of thing that's happened. What is the process of you laying out the story?
Right.
Because I'm always interested, just like I speak to musicians and I want to know how they wrote the song, not just what their influences are. How do you actually go about plotting this? Do you have a big story board, and do you create characters, and do you draw pictures in your head, and how does it all work? Because often to come out with a twist or whatever, you have to do quite a lot of thinking. You don't just sit down and write.
No. It's a sort of a complicated, difficult to explain process. I mean, it starts with, I think, just like musicians or singer-songwriters collect little phrases of maybe lyrics that can turn into something. I think authors are always collecting story ideas. Wherever we go, what we read, what we hear, what we see, what we feel, how we respond to new stuff of the day, that sort of thing. And it all goes into the back of your mind. And now and again, there's a little flash of, wow, that could be a very cool story if you extrapolate. You're always playing the what-if game. What if this happened? You read something and you turn around and say, but what about if that happened? And you're sort of evaluating, and you are both writer and reader at the same time, because the reader inside of you is always evaluating the story ideas that the writer is coming up with. And that is why I always advise people who want to write to read a lot, because the more you educate the reader inside, the better you can make a judgment call on the story ideas. Is it any good? So anyway, you collect all these story ideas, and then sometimes it happens that two ideas come together and there's a nice little spark. It's like building a puzzle. You have a lot of pieces that don't fit, and if you find two that fit and it makes an exciting picture that gets your adrenaline going, then you start going with that. And then I start reading and doing interviews with people who have a lot of specialist knowledge, and start building that little puzzle more and more with information
Do you have a lot research. Of Do you have a lot of friends and contacts in places like forensic laboratories?
I do, absolutely.
And those people, you're fascinated with that anyway, right?
Yes, I am, and I always also want to get it right. I have friends in the Hawks in Cape Town in the Serious and Violent Crimes Unit, and I talk to them a lot because I want to know what their lives are like. And if they read the book, I want them to say yes, this is credible too.
And do you ever include tangentially or maybe even more obviously the stories and the characters in real life into the fiction?
The characters not so much, because creating a character from scratch is just too much fun. Sometimes I will borrow a name from someone. I listen to the slang that the police use, so I will definitely use that. And sometimes I use actual cases and then turn it around and say, what if, and change it up a little bit. The problem with real-world crime is that it's not very entertaining. It's sad and violent and disturbing. Crime fiction, suspense fiction, it should be entertaining. So you have to find those crimes that you can build an entertaining story around.
So interesting. I just got back from New York, and we went to a podcast conference, and there was a guy talking about what the genres are that are receiving the most interest at the moment. And true crime... Yeah. Is one of the most it's emerging as the fastest growing genre in podcasting,
right?
Because again, I mean, the nice thing about audio and about books is that you can imagine your own pictures,
yeah,
right, which is something that, you know, if you let TV and movies, they do it for you,
right?
With imagination, your own picture, you can see this character looks like this in your head, and the place where it happened looks like this, and exactly. I think people like that.
People do like that, and of course that makes it so difficult to adapt something for television, because now you're forcing pictures onto them, and it's not always what they had in their mind. So you're always up against it.
Went and made Emmanuel Castus into a Muslim terrorist.
But, I mean, he was just perfect for the part, wasn't he?
No, it's great,
what a great actor he is, huh?
Yeah. Look at these awards. Leanne, you cannot believe these awards. We've got the German Creamy Award, the inaugural Artie Garfier Prize for Best Suspense Fiction. That was in 2008. You've got the Martin Beck Award. That's from Sweden. Le Prix Mystère de la Critique. From France, 2004. We've got Le Grand Prix de Littérature Policière in 2003 in France.
Jeez, you get an award for just saying that.
He's French.
This is amazing. Do you ever look?
How does it work? Are you writing in Afrikaans only?
Yeah.
And then, so how do you get an award in?
Well,
he's been published in French and German and Swedish.
My books are translated.
Translated.
I have an agent in London who sells my books to.
By the way, they might be translated. If it's Swedish, they might be writing the biggest heap of shit. You don't know, right? They could might not even
and also, do you not then lose the South African slang that you were talking about with cops, etc.?
The South African slang would be lost anyway. I mean, in Afrikaans, I have a character called Vaughn Cupido. He's a colored man from the Cape Flats. He speaks in the Cape Flats vernacular.
Yes.
And in Afrikaans, I love doing that in Afrikaans, because to me, that's the most musical, beautiful version of Afrikaans.
Yeah.
But if you're going to be English or German, that's just going to be lost on you. So you can't lose something that you never had. So I personally think nothing gets lost in translation, because story is a universal language, and the human element of characters is universal. And if you can get those right, then the novel should work in any language.
I haven't done my research, but I've seen the director's name on trackers,
right.
And I think it sounds Swedish or something
like that. Yeah, he's Finnish.
Finnish.
Yeah. And he's a great guy. He did a wonderful series for Netflix. And part of the deal that we had with HBO and ZDF and Mnet was we asked, let's use as many South African actors and actresses. Let's not get people with fake accents. We have such great talent in South Africa. Let's use them. And they said, that's fine, but we want to bring in a director who has done an international TV series before.
Because they'll bring in certain production values and things that we might not know about, or that some of our directors might not be as conversant in.
Right.
These awards that I mentioned, do they mean anything to you? Do you care about them?
Well, I certainly don't work to get them, but you know, it's a huge honor to receive them. Writing is a lonely, long marathon of a business. So when you get something like that, it makes you feel that at least it wasn't in vain. But writing also keeps you very humble, you know, and you know that you're a little bit lucky, because looking at literature, it's not an exact science, this book being better than that one. You get a little bit lucky, you have a panel whose taste tends to be more in your direction. Anyone else could have won. So I try to be very realistic about it. But it's great to get them. I mean, it's such an honor to know that you've won a Barry Award, and the great Ed McBain, John D. MacDonald, Michael Connelly have all won them. Then you think, well...
I'm in good company.
A good company from a boyke from Clarksdorp too.
I know. It's a hell of a success story. This book launch, do you enjoy those? Because you get to meet some of the people who are fanatical about your books. Some of them are pretty strange, I'm sure.
We are authors because of our readers. Readers,
does it feel like pressure though?
Yes, it does. I mean, I'm not an extrovert. One of the reasons why I write and I'm not an actor is because I love just doing my thing there in a very quiet environment. But meeting readers is part of the process. I get emails and I get all sorts of other interaction. It's hard work for me, but I must say that the readers are so delightful and so charming and that it's a real pleasure to interact with them, but it does get tiring.
Well, I mean, congratulations on all this success. I hope next time we see you, we can talk for a little bit longer and get into more of your own life story and how that, I'm sure, has made you into the brilliant literary genius that I think you are.
You're very kind. Thank you.
I think lots of people do. It's not just me. And congratulations. It's been amazing. And you also do some pretty strange things. I mean, you're a motorcyclist. You read a fortune, which is obvious, and then you also like watching rugby. So who would have known? And you were a consultant on brand strategy for BMW for a while.
Yeah, that's right.
Huh?
I got to ride from BMW motorcycles.
Right.
That was a lot of fun. We really turned the industry on its head those days.
Well, this is George Meany. He's the CEO of Auto Trader, and he comes in once a week to talk to us.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So, Dion, well done, and congratulations, and thank you for coming to see
us.
Thanks
for having me, Gareth. Thank you, everybody.
Best of luck. Trackers is on Mnet. It's an award-winning South African author at the helm of that. New audiences, unpacking a TV adaptation of his 2011 crime novel, Trackers. And don't go away. I want to chat to you in a minute. But George is here, so it's time for us to wrap up this Friday morning.
Hello,
Georg.
Hello, Leon.
What's happening, George? Oh.
Leon.
George is going to a track day with Leanne today.
Yes.
Exciting stuff.
Yep. All right.
So I had to wear a jacket today, just for you.
All right.
I didn't wear one for you.
I see that.
All right, so what's happening?
Well, anti-speeding software, built-in breathalyzers for European motorists. So if you get bussed drinking and driving in Europe, from 2022, you will be forced to install a breathalyzer in your car, which means that the car won't start unless you blow into this.
I think that the unforeseen consequence of all of this is going to be they're going to make cars less safe.
That's also very true.
The whole reason they've made them safe is because of idiots, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you stop idiots, then cars don't need to be as safe. You watch those vehicles.
That is a really long stretch.
I'm telling you that the vehicle manufacturers will find that it is cheaper to make unsafe cars. And now that everyone's being breathalyzed, they don't need to make the cars safe. I'm telling you.
Dion,
tell me that's not a good plot twist.
I think it's fiction, that's for sure.
Well, what's not fiction is they're also considering installing software that stops the car from speeding. But if you push your foot on the accelerator hard, you can override the software that intelligently stops the speeding.
So in other words, it's pointless.
It's pointless, exactly.
It's like what we've got now.
A governor.
Yes.
You could set an upper speed limit on most cars.
Yes.
I mean, Gugu's nodding his head because he's like, what, this is obvious.
Oh, I've got
cruise
one.
Cruise control.
It's not cruise control. It's speed limiting.
Yeah.
What's cruise control?
Cruise control is where you set the speed that you want to keep going at. What is wrong with you? Do you even know how? Do you know where your
Have
key,
you seen my car?
Do you know where the key
even
goes?
Even I know that.
Do you know where the key goes?
It doesn't
in your
even
car?
Have a USB port.
Oh,
that's important.
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 Oh, I get it. Oh.
So embarrassed. Dion Mayer's sitting here has to listen to this stupidity.
I'm sorry.
This man woke up early this morning to come and listen to this.
I thought that was pretty smart.
Thank you very much, Dion. Thank you.
All right. What else, George?
So there are solar roadways being developed, and it's made of glass. And it has the texture of asphalt.
Okay.
This solar roadway can handle the weight of a semi-truck, can be installed with LED lights so you never have to paint road markings.
Very good.
Hmm. And can also potentially in the future charge electric cars.
Oh, that's clever.
And therefore Leanne wouldn't need that USB port after all.
After all.
Maybe I can charge your cell phone at the same time.
Okay, but you say it can handle the weight of a semi-truck, but what if a... Because you know we would break it in this country,
in
right?
In this country, we'd break it because...
Take us 2 days.
Just our overloaded taxis would break it.
Have you seen the trailers on those taxis?
And one of those abnormal loads would come down the highway and just smash the solar road to pieces.
And what if there's no electricity to power the lights that are the road markings?
All right. You know what? Let's stop being negative.
This is solar, Leanne.
Oh, I see.
Sia's laughing at you. You must know how bad things
He's
are.
He's laughing with
Eskom
me.
Eskom does not control the sun, believe it or not.
More is the pity. Of course, the sun would have a break every now and then. Okay, what else is going on?
Do you remember the Honda Prelude?
Yes.
Honda Prelude. So the Honda Prelude was Honda's flagship little sports car.
I remember the Honda Ballade.
Yes.
Honda Ballade.
Yes, so the Honda Prelude. So most cars have a lever to put the backrest down on the left-hand side, right?
Yes.
So now the Honda Prelude was the only car in Japan with the lever to put the seat backward on the center or the center part of the seat.
Oh, in the middle.
In the middle.
Okay.
So this car did really well in places like America and Europe,
yes.
But it was an absolute failure in Japan, where the car was made.
You're telling me people wouldn't buy it just because it couldn't put the seat down on the side?
Well, this is the reason.
Amazing.
Because Japan called it the pervert lever.
How so? Oh.
Because they reckoned that when people want to have sex in the car, the person in the passenger seat didn't have a choice to pull the lever.
Oh,
because the driver could.
The driver would just reach over and do it for them.
Exactly. Ah. And this is a real story. It was called the pervert lever, and the car failed because of this lever.
But it did fine in the rest of the world.
So in the rest of the world.
Don't feel too bad, Honda, you perverts.
And that's it for this week, Gareth.
See, Dion, that's the kind of detail, right, that you would put in a novel.
Absolutely.
Honda Prelude with its pervert lever.
Exactly. Yeah. Can you imagine someone pulling that lever just as the shot goes off and a life is saved? I mean, that's exactly.
See, there we go. There's a safety mechanism.
Exactly. Yeah.
Your George. Mind must be exhaust you. Like reading a normal news story must be like a whole plot in your head.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
He's gathering information all the time. It's fantastic. Well, George, thank you very much.
You're
as
welcome.
Always, terrific stuff from George Meany, and you can find out more if you listen to Cliff Central on a Monday. We have Auto Central, where there's a much longer time. There's more bandwidth for George to share all his interesting stories. They have great guests on that show too, and we'll give you the latest in the world of motoring. And for this morning, a big thank you to Dion Mayer. Thank you to you for joining us, and we will see you on Monday. Have an excellent weekend.
This is CliffCentral.com.